Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
We should actually just record that and keep using that same thing over and over again. So a lot of New England is in mourning. The Celtics are done in the playoffs. After taking it to seven games, or actually, I guess more accurately, a lot of people would tell you, Boston / New England sports fans being what they are, they should have won it in six, because you never take the best player in the league, and everybody doesn't want to admit it, but he is.
Absolutely.
You never let the best player in the league in Game 7. It's like starting your ace in Game 7 of the World Series. Like, you kind of let the chips fall where they may, and you take it out of your hands a little bit at that point.
Well, at least they had a home Game 7. You certainly yes. don't want the best player in the NBA to have Game 7 on his home court. And by the way, one of the stats that jumped out at me in terms of LeBron is that in closeout games in his career, with him facing elimination, he's 14-9.
Yeah.
Jordan was 6-7.
Really?
Yeah. Fun fact for you.
That's interesting. It's, again, I'm going to go back to the same sort of thing that I said about Brad Marchand. If Marchand had been licking people and was a Toronto Maple Leaf or a Canadian, people would have been all over him, hanging him in effigy in... Down in Boston, if LeBron James was a Celtic or were to become a Celtic, there would be a statue of him right next to the Ducks in the public garden.
Right. I mean, there's no denying his greatness, and he's the type of player that you want on your team. And if he's not on your team, you have to find a way to discredit him, dislike him. But it comes from the fact that he's beaten them five times in the last 8 years. So there's resentment for his greatness because he's not playing for the Celtics.
Right. There's always going to be resentment for something like that. He's done it this year with as decimated of a roster as he's had. Imagine some of those guys that were playing with the Lakers not long ago, Larry Nance Jr., and thinking, yeah, this is another season where we kind of race to the bottom. And now you're playing for an NBA championship.
Very impressive. Absolutely. But equally disheartening for the Celtics fans, like you started out. It just would have been so much fun to see the Celtics in the finals.
Yes.
Because getting there would have been a major upset. And they were 6 minutes away. They were ahead in the fourth quarter of Game 7 at home.
Right.
6 minutes to go. They were right on the brink. And it just would have been awesome to watch them play Golden State. Because this year, I want to say they beat them by 1 point, and then they lost by 3 or 4. And they'd done the same thing with Houston. They just match up so well against them, and they have the versatility with all those young guys to defend Golden State's
yes.
extraordinary wing players. And they would have been a large underdog in the series, just like Cleveland is. But I really think they would have had a better performance against Golden State than Cleveland will.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's it has been interesting to watch, and the Celtics have played very well. I would have also welcomed the matchup of Brad Stevens and Steve Kerr. That would have been a lot of fun to see. Stevens, I hope we get to watch him for another 20 years with these guys. And I think if he is with them, And obviously it's not going to be the same guys, but he knows who his guys are, and he's earned enough credibility that he can be involved in player personnel decisions to get his guys. And I realize I'm not an NBA coach or a major league coach or whatever, but when you have an opportunity to coach players that fit into a certain mold from an attitude standpoint, from an athleticism standpoint, it really makes a big difference. You can plug them in, and we talk about this kind of stuff with men's basketball league. You plug people into roles, and they're willing to accept the roles because it suits their strengths. And the Celtics now have guys that are plugged into roles that fit their strengths very well. As Brad Stevens continues to assess what needs are, and work with Danny Ainge to find more players to fit more roles, the team's only going to get better and stronger.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of alignment between Coach Stevens and the Celtics front office, and they appreciate the same type of player, and they're looking for the same types of qualities. Take Marcus Smart, for instance. Danny Ainge drafts him knows that he's a hustle guy, glue guy, does all the small things we've talked about in previous shows. And he's a major impact player in a playoff series. I mean, he just does things that other guys don't do. It's not just that he gets two or three steals. It's the types of steals that he gets. He'll just go up to a player and steal the ball from his hands. It's like a play you would see in youth basketball. It's not like he's taking all these risks and jumping in passing lanes and he's not getting the steal on eight or nine plays a game and there's a backdoor layup because of it.
Right.
He's just creating these amazing defensive plays by himself. And then you look at who has really stepped up out of the blue in the playoffs, Terry Rozier. He was a mid-first round pick who wasn't, you know, projected to be a, you know, top 15 point guard in the NBA, which most people think now he could be if he was
right.
given the reins to a team. But you could tell if you thought about his strengths when he was drafted, really good defensively, hustle guy, quick, and, oh, by the way, he's got a nice shooting stroke. So, you know, he's just another example of, like you're saying, Celtics draft a guy and then Coach Stevens does the rest where he plugs him in and uses his strengths. And you just keep going all the way down the line. You know, obviously the Celtics saw something in Tatum that the Lakers and the Sixers did not because they passed on him. Obviously the Celtics saw something in Jaylen Brown that nobody else did when they picked him at number three and nobody thought he would get picked at number three. And he's just blossomed into a great young player. So very bright times ahead for the Celtics, and just a shame that they got cold. You know, Rozier went 0 for 10 in Game 7
from
3-point
land.
Well,
that seems to be the theme from all the Game 7s. And
yeah.
we had discussed it a little bit. The Rockets, you sent me a 538 article. 1 in 72,000 chance that they would go 0-4-27 in a row. Many people who would listen to this show know that for a three-point shooter, I'm only dubbed a three-point shooter because I really can't do anything else. And you can't just call a guy a screener. But I would have a hard time going 0-27 consecutively. The fact that they went 0-27 consecutively at that point in time that they basically clutched is astonishing. I looked at it. I passed out early on Monday night. I went to bed early and went to sleep. Things were in good shape. If you're a Rockets fan, what was it? 33-15 in the third quarter with that 0-27 stretch mixed in there. And yeah, indeed they missed Chris Paul, of course, but the fact that you can't hit a three in 27 tries is astonishing. The Rozier's slump as well. It was just, sometimes you just get to a point and the shots just don't go in.
It was really amazing that that happened. And the way the odds were broken down in the 72,000-1 were really interesting because what they were doing was they're combining the player's shooting percentage with how close the defender was to him when he took the shot.
Yep.
So they added it all up together, and that's what they came up with. But, yeah, 0-27. Ariza finished 0-9 for the game. Gordon was 2-12. Harden 2-13 from three-point land. And the funny thing was it almost makes it feel like Boston's shooting wasn't that bad.
Right.
Because Houston was historically bad. 27 misses in a row from three-point land is a record in the playoffs. And for a team that prides itself on shooting three-pointers better than pretty much anyone in the history of the game, you know, they made more threes this year than twos, or they attempted more threes than twos. It was the worst possible timing and just difficult to watch. They were up by 15 in the second quarter.
Yeah.
They're up by 11 at half. If they just have an average shooting performance in the second half, they win. And that's exactly what happened with the Celtics. And, you know, we talk about Game 7. That's pretty tough. That's a lot of weight on a team because you are at home and you're expected to win Game 7 at home. And both Boston and Houston dealt with that pressure against the favorites.
Right. And in the case of, like, a Jason Tatum, chronologically 2 years ago, he was still in high school. Like, that's... If you had taken me when I was a sophomore in college and said playing Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals I probably would have taken you up on it, and it probably wouldn't have gone nearly as well. So you have to admire what he has been able to accomplish. And the other interesting thing, LeBron and he talked after the game and exchanged what I would say are more than pleasantries, probably mutual admiration. You wonder how that young core that already exists, would the Celtics, and you're the NBA guy, you know, would the Celtics have a chance to get him?
Would the Celtics have a chance to get LeBron?
I mean, obviously you'd need to move some parts around, potentially damaging the Stevens Ainge plan.
I think you certainly would have a chance. The Celtics have the more assets than anybody in the NBA in terms of great young players, future draft picks. So they would have, and they now have a glut of rotation players.
Right. There aren't enough basketballs. There's not enough time.
They're deeper 1 through 8 than anybody in the NBA.
Well, particularly when Hayward and Irving come back.
Right. Next year, 1 through 8, they will be deeper than anybody. They'll have more talent. I think they'll be the favorite to win the East. So they have enough players right now that they could put a trade together, whether it's for LeBron or Anthony Davis. The question is, would LeBron want to come to Boston and potentially be reunited with Kyrie Irving? Would he want to go join the team that he's fought against so hard for so many years? I tend to think he would not. I actually think he wants to go to Houston. And I'm disappointed in Houston losing, because I think it paves the way for LeBron to go to Houston. Think about it. If Houston goes to the NBA Finals, if they win Game 7, they're in the Finals, no matter what happens. First of all, he would be playing against Houston in the Finals this year.
Yes.
He's not going to play against Houston in the Finals this year and then go join them next year. That would be a terrible look. But if he goes and joins them now that they've lost to Golden State, they, quote unquote, weren't good enough to get over the hump.
Right.
It's a whole different narrative. It's different than Kevin Durant, so he's not going to get roasted for it like Kevin Durant was. If he goes to Houston and he is the guy who takes Golden State out in the West before they get to the Finals. So I'm concerned about that. He's friends with Chris Paul. Chris Paul wants him to go there. And, for Celtics fans, why is this a potentially bad thing? Because if the Celtics get to the Finals next year and they have to play Houston with LeBron, Chris Paul, and James Harden, that's a tough, tough matchup.
It's interesting to think, though, that to me is one situation where there really aren't enough balls to go around. Because then you're asking LeBron to be a power forward, which, happy cows give good milk. What do unhappy cows give? there's no punchline there. That was what popped into my head. So thinking about the Celtics and all that sort of stuff, the Eastern Conference, some interesting stuff coming out of Philly. And I'll preface all of this by saying, as a guy who tweets, never tweet.
That's the safest way to proceed.
Uh-huh. Never tweet.
In 2018.
Yeah, just don't interact with anybody and you're good. Have conversations with people like we used to have conversations. And if you do tweet, be nice.
Yeah, and you can go on to Twitter.
That's just a general message thrown out in light of current events that I'm not going to mention this week. But if you're on Twitter, it's like your mom used to always say, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
Right.
That's probably a good one to stick with.
Absolutely. I mean,
instead of the Ambien defense. Anyway, keep going.
Go on to Twitter if you want and read other tweets. Just don't tweet yourself.
Twitter is a depressing, sad place.
It can be.
It's very sad, unless you're reading at Language Olympic, but continue.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's where you want
to
be reading.
That's uplifting and positive, but most of Twitter is depressing and sad.
Yeah, so what you're referencing, of course, is the blockbuster article that was published on Tuesday night in The Ringer.
I was impressed.
By the article?
Oh, my God. The level of journalism and what we're talking about, if you haven't heard it, Brian Colangelo, the general manager of the 76ers, got out that he may have tweeted confidential front office information in response to people that were saying negative things about him. And he wasn't tweeting that as Brian Colangelo. He was tweeting it as a variety of different other personalities that require multiple logins and multiple passwords. But the the interesting things that really stick with you out of that article, first and foremost, the Ringer reached out to Brian Colangelo. This was just shocking. And they said, hey, we found a couple Twitter accounts that look like they might be you. And they didn't say anything. So allegedly there were five accounts. They found two that they said might have been Colangelo. And that was all they said. And there were three other ones that they didn't say anything about. And they went through and archived all this information. And next thing you know, those accounts go dormant or private.
It was
like he just took the bait.
That was one of the most fascinating pieces of the story that adds circumstantial evidence to the potential conclusion that Brian Colangelo or somebody acting on his behalf was tweeting from these five accounts. Because like you say, when he specifically, Ben Dietrich, contacted the Sixers, he did it with the strategy of mentioning just the two accounts. And interestingly, the Sixers came back and admitted, yes, one of the accounts, Phila 1234567, is Brian Colangelo's burner account on Twitter, but that one didn't really have any tweets. So he was using that to just read, follow people.
Right.
And they admitted that that was his account. But like you said, within a couple of hours, the other three accounts of the five went private. So
that's a weird coincidence, right?
Really weird coincidence. And the other thing that he did was he made sure to ask them after he called and said, you know, we've got these two accounts, we're looking at them. He asked them, okay, who did you tell that I called you? And they said, well, we've only told Brian Colangelo. So it's not like they told, you know, the inner circle, 10 to 12 members of the front office in Philadelphia. And all this big group had this information. Philadelphia 76ers claim that they only told Brian Colangelo, and then it was within hours that those three other accounts went private.
I think it is a bad look for him regardless, and it's always interesting and instructive to see what happens when people get caught doing things like this, what the excuse is. The excuse then became, it was my wife posting things. Which
first
of all, that's not going to be a happy conversation at home regardless, because it's either one of two things. Hey, honey, you're about to cost me my job because you've been posting things that I've told you confidentially under these fake Twitter accounts. Thanks a lot. And then there's the flip side of it of, hey, so I'm about to get dragged under for this thing. Can you just roll over for me, please?
Yeah.
There's like either way, it's absolutely brutal. Like, I don't know. I mean, usually it's an intern that gets rolled over. Hey, there was an unnamed intern in the marketing department who had access to the Twitter account and did blank. In this case, it's dude's wife. What?
There's so many different interesting angles here. The first one with his wife, Barbara Bottini. Some of the information came out in a Deadspin article, and what happened?
I don't have Deadspin anymore.
Oh, okay.
I set it up to redirect to other things because I was going there too much.
Uh-huh.
So I set up my browser so that if I go to deadspin.com, it redirects to a spreadsheet that I need.
Self-control. Very
that
impressive.
Was it. I broke the habit. It's gone. Anyway, keep going.
So what was found out on Twitter with research is that the phone number linked to three of these burner accounts ended in the digits 9-1, and the research uncovered that Barbara Bottini's phone number ends in 9-1.
I got the plot thickens. My wife's phone number also ends in 9-1. Don't tell anybody.
So that's really what started to unearth the possibility that Brian Colangelo's wife is the one who's actually operating these burner accounts. And so then the question remains, is he instructing her to send these tweets? Is he suggesting that she sends these tweets? Or is she really acting independently, just trying to protect her husband's image by sending out all these tweets, which have a variety of purposes, all to paint a brighter picture of Brian Colangelo? What those accounts tweeted about were that, you know, Markelle Fultz is having these psychological issues. That's what the problem is. It has nothing to do with the front office. That Jahlil Okafor may have failed a physical, and that's why he wasn't traded before he actually got traded. So apparently the three accounts tweeted dozens of times about maybe Okafor failed the physical, and the accounts were sometimes directed at Philadelphia journalists suggesting that they ask the team, did Okafor fail a physical, when it had not been publicly reported that he had failed a physical. The accounts also attacked Nerlens Noel and called him a, quote, selfish punk, quote, bad for the locker room. The accounts also referenced the potential trade with Boston, the draft pick trade, where Philadelphia got the number one pick that they used to select Markel Fultz. And in exchange, the Celtics got the number three pick that they used on Jason Tatum and a Sacramento Kings first round pick for next year. And it was discussing this trade before the trade was made. So it's getting back to your point, how you described it as sensitive, private front office information that ranges from potential trades to views on the team's players, views on other teams' players. It's like something that's never been seen before in the NBA.
It's bizarre. I don't know. You hope and you wish that when somebody, if indeed it was him, if it was him and you're caught doing it, honestly, apologize. If it's your fault, resign.
Yep.
Like, go about it honorably. But to me, like, yeah, if it's his wife, bummer. That's bad. I'm sure it's not a comfortable time around the breakfast table in the Colangelo household. But if it's him and he's kind of using a completely different defense for it and throwing his wife under the bus, that's just not cool. It's not acceptable. We are in a world, unfortunately, where every time somebody gets caught red-handed doing something they shouldn't have done, there's another excuse for it. There's somebody else to blame, something to blame, some unforeseen circumstance. Like, if you screw up, own up. Like, and that's, honestly, that's one of the big reasons I watch more sports now than I probably ever have, oddly enough. And the reason is sports is cut and dried. Guy doesn't make a shot. He doesn't make a shot. It doesn't matter whether he ate his Wheaties in the morning or had the right drink before the game or didn't sleep well the night before. If he didn't make the shot, he didn't make the shot. If he didn't get the hit at the appropriate time or if he got picked off, whatever, that's on him. That's not, there's no hiding from that behind your wife or a marketing intern or the medication you were taking. Like, it is what it is. And to me, that is the best thing about sports now, that it's, yeah, it is escapist, but it takes a world where people suddenly say, yeah, you know what, that wasn't me. And it makes it so that there's no hiding from that. Either it's you or it wasn't.
Yeah, and what you're getting at is, what if it was more his wife's doing than his own? And in the end, it probably doesn't matter. I mean, that would be his defense, obviously. If you start to get into the legal side of this and his employment with Philadelphia, does he have the right to keep his job? He probably has an employment agreement that says he can be fired for certain things. You know, it's called just cause. So he could defend himself.
Says the employment attorney.
Right. He could defend himself and say, I didn't do this. It usually is that the employer has to prove you did this. So they could certainly go to court about this and fight it out. Obviously, this will never get there. If he resigns or he gets fired, they may have a negotiation about his contract and whether he's owed any more money. And they'll negotiate and something will get resolved one way or the other. This is not going to go to court. But if it did, it's kind of interesting because his wife is involved. You know, there's this thing called the marital privilege, and what you tell your wife or what a wife tells a husband.
There we go. There's our legal expert. Boom.
She's actually not allowed to testify about that. So the actual truth would likely never come out. But when you look at all the evidence, there's so much circumstantial evidence that it could have been him. It might have been him because of the information being leaked that he knew, or some of it only he knew. Then you might actually get, you know, if it were on trial, you might get a finding of, you know, he's liable for this. He's guilty of this, quote unquote, because there's just so much circumstantial evidence. It's more likely than not that either he did it, or these are comments that he made to her that she then went on ahead and tweeted about. So what we then get back to is he probably at some point, we're taping this on Thursday morning. I mean, the odds are he's going to come out and probably resign. Hopefully he owns up to it and says either I did it or my wife did it. And, you know, owns up to it, because you're right. In the final analysis, it's just a matter of, did it happen or not? Did you make the shot or did you miss it? And here, this was like going 0 for 27 from three-point land.
Yeah, just be accountable. Like, it's if you did it, it was a bummer. It was a lapse in judgment. It shouldn't have been done. Understandable on many counts. You're going to have a tough time signing free agents, too, because these guys are going to, like, immediately you're going to be in a tough situation. Not to mention, included in all that was his dislike of Sam Hinkie.
Yeah. Which to me just makes it, you know, that much worse, because I think Hinkie did a great job. I mean, I'm not about trying to lose and but if the ownership group and Sam Hinkie sat down and said, this is our plan, and Hinkie was supposed to go out and execute that plan to the best of his abilities with his trades and transactions, I think he did an excellent job. He laid the groundwork for everything that's happening in Philadelphia, and I don't think there's any debating that that's the biggest reason why Philadelphia is where they are as a franchise. It has nothing to do with Brian Colangelo. So it's so much stranger for if it's him or his wife to come out and act like Hinkie doesn't deserve the bulk of the credit here. He does.
But think about what would have happened if they hadn't swung and missed on a couple of big picks. Fultz is a strike one. Oh, it's a called strike. I don't think it's a full swing and miss yet. Nerlens Noel is another one that to me was a pretty big whiff. Okafor is
probably
whiffy.
The worst of the big men.
Yeah.
Is Okafor so far.
But you look at those and you say, wow, those are questionable. If they had the ability to evaluate talent like the Celtics evaluate talent, or, and I looked this up earlier, Curry was the number 7 overall pick. And even when he came out, he was not a sure thing. I just want to remind everybody, he was coming out of Davidson. He's too small. He's too skinny. He's too this. He's too that. Yep, he's good. They got Curry. Klay Thompson was the 11th overall. Draymond was the 35th. He was a second round pick. It's not like those marquee guys were the number 1, number 2, number 3 picks. Those guys were evaluated and reached. Draymond Green came out. He is one of the best sound bites to me in the NBA. Bright guy, clever, funny, always smile. Like, I love him. And out of college, though, he was questionable because he had sharp elbows. Like, he was always getting in something or another. Marcus Smart kind of falls into that same similar category. And guess what? They grew up. Like but you look at those three, really the only big free agent signing they have, and it's not like it was a nothing signing, was the skinny guy from Texas, Kevin Durant.
No, Golden State's done an excellent job with those draft picks that you just listed. I think the thing with Philadelphia is they probably had a theory of if we take these three big guys, let's just hope that two of the three pan out.
Yeah.
And I think if you evaluate each pick independently, there cannot be much criticism for each pick where they were picking that year in that draft. Most people agreed that each of those picks was a very good pick.
Right.
I mean, Embiid might have been the riskiest.
Because of his
injury history.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He's turned out to be the best. I'd say Noel is sort of in the middle, where he's a decent NBA player. Definitely not a bust. So far, Okafor has been a bust, but you know, he's got enough talent where I think the final story on him is yet to be written.
I think with any of those guys, You see it happen in the NFL. A quarterback gets drafted and becomes a bust because he's going to a horrible team that has no backup, no offensive line, no running game. And what do they expect? They expect the guy to throw the ball 35, 40 times, and he's 22 or 23 years old. Yeah, that can happen reasonably quickly. And the same thing in the NBA. If you don't have any kind of a team and you haven't been smart about building with any kind of free agent signings or any kind of draft picks, a guy's going to go to a team and he's going to struggle. And it's not, it's some guy, there are generational players that will put a franchise on their backs. Lew Alcindor, before he was Kareem with the Bucks, Michael Jordan with the Bulls, but Jordan needed complementary pieces in order to get there as well. There are some players that will bring a team up themselves, but those guys, I mean, I'm talking about two of the top five players in NBA history. A lot of these big guys, if you just chuck them on a roster, it's tough. So, and I'm going to take us back. So this is a Bedford sports show.
Yes, it is.
So a lot going on in the Bedford world of sports. Like, I'm sitting here. We got Little League tonight. Little League playoffs are starting. So, like, that's the craziness. High school. So I guess we'll take it further back. Of course, Grant Levine, who we had on the show a couple weeks ago, who did a wonderful job in his interview. Grant and the Bedford High Bulldog baseball team will start the playoffs on Saturday. You guys, I will not be there. I have to work an event, although I hope to actually show up and leave. You guys will have the call here on Bedford 105.1 of that game. But those guys are heading into the playoffs, and we talked about it the other day. With a loss to Pinkerton, a tough game, hard-fought win over Alvern. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. It's a good, solid core, but it's a single elimination tournament.
It is, and the Saturday will be the quarterfinals, so they've got to win three. We touched on it a little bit briefly, the idea of what happens if you lose once and your undefeated season doesn't play out like you had hoped. I think depending on the team, it can be beneficial. And to have these two really close games to end the regular season, you lose one, then you win one, I think it does a lot for a team. It gets you on edge.
Yes.
It gets you focused, motivated. You feel the fact that on any given day, you can lose. This is baseball. And it's just much better to have that scare in the regular season. So you regroup, you get refocused, and you try and get back to the team that you know you can be, which is scoring in double digits, you know, having excellent pitching performances from guys like Jeff Mosso, and whether it's a no hitter or a shutout, they've got so much talent pitching and hitting that it's going to be a lot of fun to see if they gel here at the perfect time.
And that's what you build for. You build for the playoffs. You build so you have the right guys in the right roles that are able to pull it out when they need to pull it out. So they'll play. Who do they have 4 o'clock on Saturday?
I think it's the play-in game is today, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, there you go. So they don't know. They have
the
first
eight and
round
nine.
Play.
The 8 and 9 seeds have the play-in game. I don't think that was last night. I think it's today.
So
this is Thursday.
I believe that you're correct because I had this one as a tentative on my schedule. But and then Bedford High Tennis, of course, has been rocking and rolling. They, like the boys baseball team, had that late loss, but things went very well for them in the playoffs.
Yeah, boys tennis took the state championship on Tuesday, the team event. Girls tennis took the state championship on Wednesday. So already a great week for Bedford Athletics. Congratulations to those two tennis teams.
And it's nice to see the Bedford boys team start off a winning streak. same thing happens to UConn, right? You lose, you start a new streak.
Yeah, and it's funny. Usually when you have a winning streak that spans multiple seasons, you know, it doesn't end. If you go back, you figure, okay, the last loss they had was in the playoffs last year. Or if it's, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, you think, oh, they're 81-1, and the one must have been in the playoffs you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. But in fact, their loss was in the regular season.
Yeah.
So they've started the new streak with the state championship, which is a lot of fun.
It's a good way to start. And for the boys on the team, that's guys who are graduating seniors, have 4 straight titles. It's not a bad way to go out. Yeah.
That's just how you draw it up.
Yeah, that's how you draw it up. So looking, baseball is looking good going into the playoffs. Hopefully I'll get a chance to see some of those games. The Little League schedule conflicts mean that I may or may not be there. It's that time of year. I looked at the schedule. I was like, yeah, I could theoretically do it, but I'm going to drive myself nuts in the process. So leave it in your capable hands with the others, and tennis as well. And then softball got knocked out yesterday. Tough one for the girls. They wound up getting 4 hit in the playoff opener. 7-13 to end the season. Coach Jay Brewster, though, he's been around the softball scene for a very long time. And what he is trying to do at this point, it's interesting. He's trying to continue to build the program through the younger ranks and get more talent to the high school level, more girls interested in playing. And by doing that, give him the opportunity to pick from a bigger pool. And you see it. I mean, I've been at the complex and seen JV games, and there is talent at the JV level. So he'll have some seniors that graduate. He'll be able to restock with some very capable younger players who will come in and make an impact for that softball team as well. So that's really all you're trying to do. It's tough with a program like that to continue to build talent. And when we talked to Bob Luby with the tennis program, they're really looking at what kind of talent can we get out of Lurgio and what exposure do the kids get coming up into Lurgio to continue to feed that high school program. And town's fortunate. They have some very capable coaches at the junior high level as well as at the youth level.
Yeah, with all these sports, the road to a championship does not start freshman year when you come out and try out for the team. It's developed and built well before that. And, you know, Coach Luby was quick to give that credit to the Lurgio program. And that's how it works for all these sports.
So congratulations to everybody that continues on in the high school ranks. Even if their season's over, there's a lot of hard work that goes into everything. Not, like you mentioned, not just one season. It's a culmination of a number of seasons. And while we're thinking of it as well, I noticed you have some notes about hockey.
Yeah, the
given,
NHL.
And I'm figuring that's your haiku.
Let's see. Not yet, because we're Thursday morning. So
yeah, okay.
Later in the day, I will be writing about Brandon Holtby's save.
I figured you would go to Brandon Holtby, yes. Yeah. That was the number one play on ESPN, too.
Wow. About 2 minutes left in the third period. Capitals are up by 1. The puck gets sent across the crease. Vegas has an open net. And he just swings around with his stick and blocks it with just below his blocker and somehow grabs it with his hand and just basically it's almost like glue. He just snags it and stops it and by doing so gives the Capitals a real chance in this series by evening it up at 1 because Vegas got the opener. 6-4.
Right, and it's been a great series of hockey so far. It's what you expect for the Stanley Cup Finals. That one, that would have been, I can say this as an LA Kings fan from back in the day, I still shudder at the memory of this, and I don't know if we talked about it or if I dreamed that we talked about it, but I know that I looked it up in recent weeks. There was, in the 1993 Stanley Cup Finals, famous play, Jacques Demers, the head coach of the Montreal Canadiens, requested that the officials look at Marty McSorley's stick. And he thought that McSorley's stick was too curved. And sure enough, and this is with about 2 minutes left, I want to say it was game 3, game 4, I don't remember. I believe it was game 3. With about 2 minutes left, he signals to the officials, please check McSorley's stick. They check McSorley's stick. Sure enough, it's been bent, the curvature exceeds the allowable amount. Penalty, Canadians go on the power play, tie the game, win it in overtime. and that was back in 93, and you look back and say, okay, if Vegas scores that goal with a minute and 55 left yesterday, what happens then? Like, suddenly you're down, right? You're not down yet because now the game's tied at 2 apiece. But then you have to deal with the deflation of we were 2 minutes away. You had no overtime. All bets are off in overtime, of course. But a lot can happen, and losing that momentum late is really difficult.
Oh, I mean, you're right. First of all, with the 90s incident with McSorley, talk about strategy and well-timed strategy. That's perfect.
And, well, at that point, he had nothing to lose.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, hey, you ask for it, and great.
Only good things can happen.
Timing was right. Yep.
Yeah. But with that save, if the Capitals go on to win the series, you have to look at that as that's the turning point. Because the other thing about, you know, being deflated is that in that third period last night, the Capitals had to kill off a 5-on-3 power play in the middle of the third period. So they do that. Hopi's gaining confidence. Wow, we just killed off a 5-on-3. And then that save happens. If it had not happened, if they had tied it up, they would have been thinking, oh my gosh, we just killed off a 5-on-3. We thought we had this. 2 minutes left, they score. And then you got to deal with the momentum, the home crowd, Vegas going crazy. And wouldn't have surprised anybody if Vegas had gone on to win it. But Hopi just, he changed the game.
It's insane how that can happen. And you look at the athleticism of Holtby to get that done. And I just went back and Googled something on the Marty McSorley incident. It was 1:45 left in game two. The Kings were up 1-0. And allegedly a Montreal police officer walked into the Kings locker room and examined the sticks.
Yeah. Wow.
So, and that comes from the estimable Luc Robitaille, who was told that by a Montreal policeman.
Pulling out all the stops.
I know, seriously. Hey, whatever it takes, man. It's a Stanley Cup. So, and we touched on it briefly. Gambling, the legalization of such gambling. It's funny. They mentioned it on SportsCenter this morning. They were talking about the Reds being plus 850 underdogs, trailing 4-0 in the fourth inning. Like, this stuff is all going to become part of the vernacular much more quickly than it already has.
Yeah. I noticed that the other day, too. I think it must have been on Wednesday. It must have been yesterday. I was just looking at the game time of the hockey game on ESPN, and right beneath the game where it says game two, Capitals at Vegas, right below it, it said Vegas minus 152.
Yeah.
And, you know, 6 weeks ago, they're not putting that on the front page of ESPN.
Right.
And now all of a sudden, it's accompanying the announcement of the game time. It's who's the favorite and by how much. And the other stat I heard, you know, even other talk show programs start to talk more and more about it. And on one of them, I heard that the series, the NBA Finals, which starts tonight, Golden State is a minus 1,000 favorite.
Yep.
That is monstrous.
Yeah.
There's only been a couple that have, in the last 25 or 30 years, there's only been a couple other series where the favorite is minus 750 or greater. One of them was the Lakers, and they went on to win. The other one was, they were minus 2,000. The other one was minus 750, and the favorite won. And that gets me to a question I want to pose to you.
Yes.
Do the Cavaliers have a chance in this series?
If you're asking me if I would throw down $100 to win $1,000, I think you could find worse ways to spend your money, by all means.
Sure. You certainly could.
It's the, who knows? Do I think Ty Lue is tactical enough to beat that team? That's where I kind of struggle. Ty Lue was a cerebral player coming out of Raytown, Missouri and Nebraska. But do I think that even with that, the assembly of players that they have should lose to the Warriors. But again, anything can happen.
I think the only chance they have is if somebody else gets hurt for Golden State. Iguodala is out for game one. So that gives Cleveland a much better chance. And if they could steal one in Golden State, they get a little confidence. You know, the odds of them actually winning the series go up a lot. But Kevin Love is questionable for game one as well. I think they really need him. And legitimately, they need one of those other four All-Stars to get hurt. And of course, you never hope for that. You never root for that. But that's what changes the series. I think if Chris Paul doesn't get hurt, I think it's very likely that Golden State wins game seven. That Houston wins game seven at home. And so he's a perfect example of one injury to a star changes everything. So I think that's the only chance Cleveland has. But we'll have to wait and see on Kevin Love, because he's a big X factor for him. If he stays in concussion protocol for more than a game or two, I think the series is five games at the most.
Right. So that one will be interesting to check in on, by all means. And I'm sure we'll do some further talking about that as well in coming weeks, because I don't know how it happened. It used to be the NBA Finals was in its waning moments now, and we got another couple weeks of basketball left. It'll be going till the middle of June. The only question is whether the Bedford Men's Basketball League gets done before the NBA guys are done. I know that we start before the college players do, and we end after they do.
Yeah, it's a long season.
Getting too old for this, dude. There's too many miles on this body.
It's rugged. It's a long season. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. But it helps us get through the winter up here.
Yeah, it helps you stay in a reasonable amount of shape,
right,
as you get through the winter. So we've been talking for about 47 minutes, give or take. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back. You've been listening to... Back here on Fox on Sports, the advantage that the guys who do the big sports shows do, I mean, like bigger than us, is
there's only a few of them, but
I know it's just a couple. It's a really short list. They get commercial breaks. We don't.
Right.
We just talk.
They have teams of strategists with.
They have show producers that actually go and get guests for them.
Get
novel
guests.
Concept.
You send them stats.
I did not do my job as the show producer this week because I actually had to work. You know,
we'll give you a pass.
I appreciate the fact that I get a pass for that. But it's, again, a crazy sports week. I'm wondering, because it seems like it never used to be quite this crazy. And I wonder if it's this information overload that we have access to that really you can get it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week if you want it.
Yeah. And without fail, every week there's some new compelling information, scandal, development, trade. It's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And a lot of it is some of these guys can't help themselves, whether it's on Twitter, you have to make a comment, whether it's talk show guys with hot takes. I would say that I think we probably have the coldest takes of any talk show anywhere. I'm just not a hot take guy. But
intelligent takes.
Yes.
You know, that's a separate category.
Yes.
We're not going for sensational takes. We're going for intelligent takes.
No, I really don't want to interview Jim Everett and
get in a fight.
I mean, you know, that made Jim Rome's career, but yeah, we've talked about that before. The Brian Colangelo thing to me still stands out as weird. The weirdest part in a story that is resplendent with weird parts was somebody went after Colangelo's shirt collars, and Colangelo or Colangelo's wife sprung from their chair, phone in hand, in defense of shirt collars.
Right. We're talking about
collars.
Shirts?
Yeah.
Collars? They are large collars.
Really?
And we're not talking about collars to a radio station show. We're talking about collars, collars, his shirt collars. And as I've read more about his wife, apparently she's Italian, and apparently there is an Italian flavor to these shirts. And it sort of supports the theory, the evidence, the circumstantial evidence coming out that maybe she's behind three of these burner accounts, that, you know, out of nowhere, she's saying, leave the callers alone. Get a new slant.
Somebody used Photoshop and gave him collars that look like a neck brace. I mean, that's a good idea, though. I mean, if this NBA thing doesn't work out for him, he can always team up with LeVar Ball, and it could be Big Baller, Big Collar.
Well, there you go. That, you know,
no more Shot Collar, Big Baller. It's Big Baller, Big Collar.
And the Ball family's back in the news with LiAngelo getting a private workout with the Lakers, and I saw a clip of it. He's running up and down the court shooting jump shots. Really didn't look that great to me. I mean, he looked like an average, maybe slightly above average 19 or 20-year-old. And then the Lakers come out and, you know, tell USA Today Sports behind the scenes that they don't anticipate drafting him or even signing them to their G League team now. So, you know, that's how the Lakers kind of, you know, treated the family well by having Lonzo's brother in for the workout, but then gently let the news out that, well, we're probably not going to sign him.
Right, and Rob Pelinka has a very solid basketball background, was an agent for some time, played in the, I love this, played in the Schlitz Malt Liquor Summer League in the Chicago area when he was at Michigan. And you go through and you look at the names of the sponsors of the teams in that league, as well as the fact that it was called the Schlitz Malt Liquor League, but it was back in a day when the NBA's best player, Michael Jordan, was playing in that league. In the late 80s, Rob Pelinka was playing against Jordan.
Well, hey, if he can play in that league, then he can hold his own.
It has been interesting to see, and you have to figure that a guy who was a good agent in that league and has had some big-time contracts under his belt when he was doing that could have done well financially, but it seems that this might have just been an unchecked box for him. But he's handled himself well to this point. They thoughtfully, as much as I might disagree with it, noted basketball mind that I am, they drafted Lonzo Ball, and they drafted him for a reason.
Yep.
So it's this wasn't a we're drafting him because of his name. This was a we have a reason to do it. So,
and as Pelinka continues on with his role, you know, probably by our next show, we'll know if Colangelo is going to continue on with his role in the Sixers. But what has happened with that news is that it's just pervasive in our minds. I can't stop thinking about it throughout my day. And so the last haiku I wrote, I mean, I thought I was writing about Yankees versus Astros and this crazy pitch and play from Aroldis Chapman, but I was also sort of writing about Colangelo at the same time. Here's what happened. Chapman's 100 zings over the playing field, off the wall burner, gathered on the fly, catcher rights end to the scheme, runner out at third. The new man in town manages key stroke from home, extra frame ends game. Was I talking about Colangelo or the Yankees?
It was a lucky bounce the Yankees got.
If you haven't seen that play, you got to see it. I mean, I've never seen anything like it before. First of all, Chapman is throwing 100 miles per hour. You know, he's just phenomenal with his arm speed. The ball goes off the backstop, bounces directly back to Gary Sanchez, the catcher. He turns and throws to third and gets the Astro out as the third out in the top of the 10th in a 5-5 game. And then the new man in town who's managing the keystroke from home, not keystrokes on a keyboard while tweeting, but the keystroke with the bat was Gleyber Torres, and he hits an opposite field single, and the Yankees get a walk-off win against the Astros in a potential playoff preview of two of the best teams in baseball.
Keep in mind, too, Sanchez really isn't throwing a whole lot of guys out on the bases these days.
So that one was sort of gift wrapped.
That was absolutely gifted. The past 2 years he has. He's been 40%-ish. This year he's at 19%, which is under the league average. So he went from 2 years of being above league average to now he's well below league average as far as catchers go. So yeah, he got a gift wrapped caught stealing on that one. hey, take it where you can get it, right?
Well, good thing that he can hit home runs himself.
Right. Oh, it's, yeah, I don't know. He is valuable with the bat.
He's no Pudge Rodriguez.
Right. Well, and sometimes you see stuff in Major League Baseball where you wonder, how has nobody exploited it the way that they have? The day that the Red Sox ran all over Kevin Gausman, stole five bases against him, and I heard somebody describe it on, it might have been Scott Van Pelt, describe it as, it was like watching a JV game where people are yelling, step off, and he just couldn't get it in his mind to step off. And I've been there. I remember being like 15 or 16 and probably a little bit younger, and your brain goes, the guy's going, they're yelling at me to do something, and I haven't quite gotten there yet. All right, I'm just going to go to the mound, or I'm going to go to the plate, and the guy steals a base, or you go to pick him off, and the guy winds up waltzing into second base. So I've been there. You just don't expect a guy at a major league level to do that.
Yeah, and I remember seeing those plays. Those guys just got huge running jumps, and he didn't do anything about it. And it is a play that you practice at the JV level, the varsity level in high school. I mean, you name it. It's simply step off.
Yeah.
You see, that's what the first baseman is supposed to stay.
Yeah.
Right when the guy starts running towards second base, you yell, step off. And all you have to do is step back off the runner, off the rubber, turn to second, and the guy is in a rundown.
And I'm still getting back to that Sanchez play. I'm still mystified at, first of all, he catches the ball clean off the backstop. And it just felt weird.
It's really freaky. The angle of the back wall has to be perfectly, it is angled. And if it wasn't that angle, the play wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And the height of that padding looks like it's about 5 or 6 inches.
Yeah. It just came right back. Did you see, speaking of weird things, last night, so Wednesday night, the Angels and Tigers with the goose that flew into the scoreboard?
No.
Yeah, so that was weird too. A goose flew into the scoreboard. The Tigers have now dubbed it the Rally Goose. And the goose has been taken out of the ballpark, and everything is okay with said goose. But Pedro Gomez, after the game, starts asking Mike Socha about the goose. Socha, of course, the longtime Angels manager, says something about, my family had a duck as a kid, so I'm familiar with birds. And then Gomez asks another question, and Socha goes, don't we have anything better to talk about?
Well, you'd think that a manager who's been in the same seat for over 20 years would appreciate something different to it talk
just,
about.
Yeah. Sometimes you just get weird stuff, and you have to do the – and that's the other thing. It's not like he's a new guy and he's got to play along. He can verbally eye roll at Pedro Gomez.
Yeah, he's got some security in his position.
Yeah, he's fine. Arte loves him. Like, they're good.
We're talking about goose?
We're talking about geese.
Goose Gossage?
A gaggle of geese. Yeah. So that was, I'm sitting in the kitchen fixing my coffee up, and I hear my wife in the next room, because I always sports, like, it's routine, sports center, workout, coffee, whatever, like, not necessarily in that order. She had plopped down on the couch, and I hear this, oh, my God. And I go walking in there. What happened? You're never going to believe this. Nope. Yeah.
Animals and baseball.
Randy Johnson. Yep.
They come into play more than in any other sport.
Cats on the field.
I mean, you name it. Cats, foxes, birds, bees.
It's, midges. Jabba Chamberlain. He will never forget. That was ages ago. That was what, 2006 playoffs. Yeah. It's always crazy stuff going on in the world of sports. And the moral of the story is don't tweet. Although I'm sure the goose already has a Twitter account.
Yeah, there's a couple new Colangelo burner accounts that are out there.
Yeah.
And
the goose's Twitter account just says honk, honk, honk. All right, I'm done. Thank you to everybody here at Bedford 105.1 for all of their support. And thanks to Harry Kozlowski for the production, as well as Chris Gentry, Bill Jennings, Colleen Richardson. Thanks to my co-host here, Andrew Hansen. And have a lovely sports weekend. We will catch you next week. And don't forget to listen to Hansen Saturday at 4 o'clock. Or go to the game at the SAU field. Should be a good one, regardless who the Bulldogs are playing against. It's playoff time, baby. We'll catch you next week. If you've been listening to Fox on Sports, Bedford 105.1.